This is Shutters Inc. with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 354 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from ShuttersIncPodcast.com. No Glyn this week, but stepping in his place, David Marlant from Central Victoria. How are you?
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Bruce. Happy birthday to you.
Thanks, mate. That was yesterday.
Yes, I know, but it's a bit weird. It was yesterday, and we're recording today, and we're broadcasting
3 days from now. So,
but that explains why you asked me to step into this little box marked police box.
I did. TARDIS. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, well, thank you for that.
That's all right.
How have you been?
Pretty good, thank you. I've been able to get out and take a few photos each week.
Oh, cool.
It's raining down here still.
Oh, okay.
So the waterfalls are running.
Oh, nice.
So trying to go well with waterfalls and enjoying my new lenses.
Oh, what lenses did you get?
Well, the story's got to be told. I mean, the previous lens I had was a 17-70 Sigma that I'd had for 7 or 8 years. It was, you know, it went at 17, it was 2.8, and it was about 6.5 at the 70 end. And I've taken it through water, I've taken it through rocks and things like that. And I was sitting at my desk as I am now and moving backwards and forwards on my chair and just moved with my elbow sort of like this.
Oh.
That was a fly spray.
Right.
But, yeah, the lens just shattered.
Ay, ay, ay.
So I had to suss out a new lens.
Yep.
And I had a chat to some guy called Glyn.
Yep.
And I picked up a couple of Tamarons.
Nice.
Because for the price of one Canon L series 24-70 2.8,
yep,
I got the Tamron 24-70 2.8 and the 15-30 2.8.
Oh, nice.
That 15-30, I burned at a workshop with Glyn, had a little play with it and fell in love with it almost immediately.
Yeah, right.
And, I've...
Now, is that 15-30 for APS-C or for 35mm?
35mm.
Nice.
So any ideas of buying a full frame are on the back burner, but I'm now equipped if I do try.
At least now you got the glass for when you do.
Exactly. But I think it's actually helped my photography. I'm finding the glass has contributed to the clarity of the photos or the richness of the photos.
Right.
I don't know how to explain it.
Okay.
But they're different.
So how old was the old lens?
Oh, about 7 years.
Okay.
It had been the first lens I'd bought after the stock standard lens you get on the camera.
Yeah.
And I hadn't realized that, you know, having a much higher quality lens could lend so much quality to the photograph. So I'm very pleased with it. They're pin sharp,
yep,
photos, and I thought my previous photos were sharp, but these have just got that little extra to them. I don't know how to explain it. It
nice.
Might be the coatings. It's just, and it might be better resolution of contrast. It could be anything like that. But, yeah, pretty impressed.
Nice.
And
nice.
Having fun.
Excellent. That's the main thing.
Well, yeah, that's what we're doing for. What about yourself?
I haven't picked up the camera since the wedding a week and a half ago. I lie. I had to go out over the weekend with Max and take some photos because he's doing a geography assignment and he needed some photos around the Central Coast. So we went and photographed a few building sites and we photographed some mock-ups of him surveying people. So, yeah, so I took a handful of shots on the weekend. So, yeah.
Helping him with his homework.
That's it, yeah.
Now.
Thought I'd left all that behind 30 years ago.
Oh, well, that's great doing that, getting together and having – it's fun in a different way.
Yeah.
So am I game enough to ask about the bike?
Mate, I got it back this morning. 6.5 weeks off the road. I was not impressed. I was seriously starting to get very agitated over the last 48 hours or so, simply because it seemed that every time I rang the shop, you know, there was another excuse for why they hadn't completed the work. So, yeah. So I was very pleased yesterday afternoon on my birthday to, you know, be able to ring the shop at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And he said, mate, it'll be ready to go, you know, close the business today. And I said, okay, great. I'll be there at 8:30 in the morning to pick it up. So, so I picked it up this morning and it is amazing. It's like a new bike again.
Wow.
Here's a really interesting thing. Obviously, as a professional audio engineer, my ears are very attuned to everything I hear. I guess I'm a little bit sensitive to the things that I hear that a lot of other people don't hear.
Yep.
In all the time I've owned this motorcycle, which is now 27 months, there's been this high-frequency rattling in the engine. Oh. And I had spoken to the Triumph dealer from whom I bought the bike in Sydney and the Triumph dealer up here on the Central Coast. And mechanics at both stores had said to me, no, that's just the way those engines sound. And I thought, okay, is this just me being hypersensitive because I'm just used to listening for things? Or, you know, because I felt like, well, I really should trust these guys' judgment. They are both authorized Triumph mechanics. Theoretically, they know what a Triumph should sound like. So I let it go. But when all this unfolded 6 weeks ago, when the engine, you know, self-imploded, and as the, you know, the wheels of motion turned horribly slowly for those first few weeks, I was thinking to myself, I will bet my bottom dollar that when I get this engine back, rebuilt, I'll bet that rattle's gone. And sure enough, I got to the bike shop this morning, I fired it up, not a trace of that rattle. So I was definitely right in my suspicions that something wasn't right all along. And presumably it was just a cam chain tensioner issue. I don't know. But it's certainly a smoother sounding engine now than it's ever been in all the time I've had it, even from when it was new. And of course I got new tires put on it at the same time because I was only 2,000 Ks away from my next service when this happened. And I generally get I get 16,000 Ks out of a set of tires, which is the service interval for the bike. So I was getting ready to put, you know, new tires on it at the next service anyway. So when all this happened, I said to them, look, just do the remainder of the 64,000 K service while you've got it, you know, because most of the things that would have been covered by that service were going to be done by virtue of the fact that the engine's being rebuilt anyway. So just do all the other bits and pieces as well. So, yeah, so it's gorgeous. Like I said, you know, new tires, new engine, it feels like a whole new bike. So,
oh, look, that sounds fantastic. The you talk about how it sounds to you. I can remember when Dad got our car serviced when I was quite young, the guy that did the mechanics, the best mechanic that he reckoned he ever had.
Right.
Turned out he'd been an aircraft mechanic in World War II.
Right.
For the Air Force, and he used to use a stethoscope to tune a car.
I've heard that. Heard of that.
That's how he did it. That's how he was taught to tune an engine, and that's what he did.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, back then, you know, we always went, Dad always went back to him, and the cars ran flawlessly.
Yeah.
Fantastic job.
Yeah. Do you know, I was talking to one of the guys at the bike shop this morning and I was saying, oh, you know, I still kick myself to this day because my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, was a diesel mechanic for the British Army in the Second World War. And prior to that, prior to the Second World War, he had worked for three different motorcycle companies, for AJS, for Matchless, and for Ariel, building those motorcycles, but, you know, back in the 30s.
Yep.
And he used to prepare the race bikes for the TT, for the Isle of Man.
Oh,
and,
wow.
You know, as a teenager, I never appreciated that deeply enough for the wealth of experience that it was. And to this day, I kick myself for not learning more about engines from him when I had the chance. Yeah.
Yeah, well, hindsight's hindsight's the only 2020 vision.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Anyway, we should talk some photography.
Oh, yeah. Why not?
the only thing that I came up with this week, and I didn't even come up with it this week. I had it last week and forgot to mention it. this was a story on Petapixel, and it's about a new smartphone that Kodak have released. I don't know if this came across your radar in the last week or two, but it's called the Kodak Ektra, and it is a smartphone designed for photographers. And what I thought was really interesting about the design of this thing is that it has like a bulbous grip on one end of the phone like a normal camera would have, like a hand grip, kind of makes it an odd design for a smartphone because it's always going to feel like you've got this lumpy thing in your pocket.
Yep.
But, you know, what makes this interesting is I think, yeah, having come from Kodak is it's designed to be a camera before it's designed to be a phone. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how many units they sell. It's a 21-megapixel sensor, f2.0 aperture that's the main camera. And then your front, like your selfie camera, if you like, is a 13-megapixel with f2.2 aperture. So, yeah, interesting-looking beast. It's running Android 6.0, that's Marshmallow, shoots 4K video and, yeah, a whole bunch of other stuff. So a very interesting-looking beast. I'll be keen to see whether or not I ever see any of these in the wild.
Look, it will be interesting. They're saying here it's going to be initially launched in the UK, which is interesting market to go to.
Yep.
And just looking at the pictures of it, it's you know, a couple of the controls on the side are very reminiscent of a camera.
Yeah.
There, so it's a camera with a phone attached rather than the other way around.
Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah, and it's got that leatherette
sort of look to it.
Finish to it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Serious looking lens on it.
Yep.
So they've made a big point of the lens. Instead of sort of stuffing it away in a corner or anything, it's right, you know, the middle upper part of
It's really, you know, front and center, so to speak.
Yep.
It really looks like a, well, not center, but you know what I mean. Like it's in terms of its placement, it's sort of conspicuous, shall I say, in its placement. You know, as you say, it's not just tucked away in a corner like is so often the case. Yeah, with your smartphones, it's so obvious that this was designed to be a great camera that also is a phone.
So, yeah, Kodak seems to be, at the moment, a photographic company looking for a purpose.
I guess. I haven't really been following everything that they're doing. I mean, I know, you know, we all know that they went through severe financial hardship, 5 years ago or thereabouts, and went very close to bankruptcy. They seem to be hanging on by the skin of their teeth. And in a way, I'm kind of barracking for them. I'd like to see them get back on their feet, you know?
Well, they were the people that brought the camera to the people.
Yeah.
Eastman's, you know, idea was the celluloid film and the, you know, basically you took the photo and sent the camera in originally and the camera came back refilled and with all your photographs. So
right.
That's how it was done originally.
Wow.
With the box brownie. So he brought photography to the masses. And apparently at the time when he brought it in, there was a hue and cry from the artistic photographers, you know, fancy giving it to the common people. It was interesting because a couple of shows ago you talked about the pictorialists.
Yes.
The pictorialists that were getting upset about it. They were upset at anybody that didn't, you know, follow their interpretation.
Yeah right. Wow.
So Eastman basically brought photography to the people. And, I mean, their museum and things like that have got an amazing resource.
Yeah, right.
But also they had the first digital camera.
I know. We mentioned that about, 8 or 10 months ago. It just boggles the mind, you know, that, you know, one of their engineers took the idea to management and management poo-pooed it and knocked it on the head.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's all about mindset, isn't it?
Yeah. It's as I think I might have said at the time that story came up, it reminded me of the whole incident with Decca knocking back the Beatles, you know, saying, you know, we don't believe that guitar-based rock and roll has a future, you know. that was Decca's rejection letter to the Beatles.
Oh, I bet you've got that in a gold frame somewhere. You'd have to, wouldn't you?
Imagine being the guy who put his signature on the bottom of that letter.
5 years later, he wouldn't.
Oh, imagine 50 years later.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you'd be
perpetually
embarrassed. You'd be throwing yourself off a building, I think. Anyway, next thing was something that Adam sent, which he posted to the Facebook wall today. And again, this is from Petapixel, and this is a story of a camera called the Kronos 1.4, and for a mere $2,500, which presumably is US, this thing...
Just a snip.
Hey?
Just a snip.
Yeah. This thing will shoot 21,650 frames per second.
What?
That's awesome.
What?
Yes.
What?
21,650 frames a second. Hence the name Kronos. Like, this thing stops time, pretty much. A homebrew...
Well, I did make the reference to the TARDIS. So.
Yeah, exactly. A homebrew high-speed camera. Yeah, that's just crazy.
And it looks just like someone's got a... Almost like one of those boxes you buy at an electronics store. And
it does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, been down to JCar and bought a project box and then cut the holes and mounted everything in it. Now, admittedly, you know, this highest frame rate of 21,650 frames a second is limited to a fairly low resolution. It's 640 by 96 pixels. So it's not exactly, you know, 4K it ain't. But even so, 21,000 frames a second, that is pretty epic.
Looking at the at some of the pictures down below here where, you know, the balloon bursting in water.
Yeah.
And slowing right down. Even its resolution might not be great. And I mean, it's only edition one.
Yes.
I think given what you can see here, the drilling the metal, resolution's almost secondary in a way. I mean, these commonplace things just look amazing.
Yeah, I was going to say, you would put aside any criticism of the minimal resolution in favor of being able to see things that you would normally not have a hope in hell of seeing, or certainly of capturing with your own equipment in your own backyard anyway.
But it's no slouch, because it says here and at 1,057 frames per second at its maximum resolution of 1280 by 1024.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's, you know, it's not quite full HD, but it's only one step down from that. And at, you know, as you say, 1,000 frames a second, you can do some good YouTube videos with that.
Oh, I'd reckon. And the size of the camera, it's actually quite small. It's as small as a point and shoot by the looks, with just an extended, looks like a cine lens they've got on it.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah. But that, I mean, that's astounding.
Yeah.
And again, for first up go, yeah, we'll keep an eye on this.
Definitely. Definitely.
It was interesting because I heard a review somewhere else the other day, and they were rubbishing the fact that some cameras don't have full 4G.
4K?
4K, sorry, 4K resolution. I mean, it's never bothered me. I'm not really into video, but, you know, because they think every camera's now got to have it or it's not worthy of review yet. I think people are forgetting the creative possibilities of what you can do with other things.
Right.
And so you dismiss...
As in, higher frame rates at lower resolution?
Higher frame rate, lower resolution, using it more mainly as a still camera. Yep. You know, it doesn't remove a lot of your creativity. The limitations of the camera get you to explore different things. And I think that... Sure. You know, just poo-pooing a camera because it doesn't have a feature because, it's on our phones, therefore we expect everything to have it. that sort of defeats the purpose a bit.
Yeah.
This sort of thumbs its nose in a way by saying, well, we haven't got the resolution, but gee, look what else we got.
Yeah, we've got the frame rate out the wazoo.
Yeah. That's an amazing camera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As Glyn is fond of saying, these are interesting times in which we live.
So, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, before we get onto the stuff that you sent me, there was one other thing that I had that I failed to send through to you in the in the list of stuff, and that was a reply from Rob Coates. So if you, I don't know if you're up to date with the previous episodes, David.
Yes.
But Rob sent us a letter a couple of episodes back, you know, asking whether or not he should go out and dump $5,000 on a new camera. And Glyn and I completely overlooked the sarcasm that was intended in his email. And he took us to task on that. And he's written again, "Dear Inks, I'm very depressed. I just sent my best three photos to Keegan, the photo coach. He told me I need to buy a much better camera. Regards, Rob Coates."
That's irony.
Thanks, Rob. And Glyn never did send me the photos that he'd submitted to Keegan, the photo coach, live during the recording of last week's episode. So I still don't know what those images were. And anyway,
chased him up next week and chastised vigorously.
Yeah, by which stage you'll have forgotten, you know, which images it was that he actually submitted.
Yes.
Anyway, so what do you got on your list?
Well, I did a little bit of looking around DP Review, there's a couple of landscape and wildlife photographer of the year things that have been announced, and I think these are of interest because they just show the variety of interpretations. The interesting one about the landscape photographer of the year is it's a little abstract, but it's basically a vortex of starlings, which are blurred against a background. And I think that's the Brighton Pier that is burnt in the background.
Right, right.
And it's obviously a lengthy exposure because you've got the white of the water there, but it's more an abstract than a classical landscape.
I actually don't think that is a slow shutter speed because the waves look reasonably well defined. And I think what gives the impression that it's a slow shutter is just the massive quantity of birds in the foreground, which almost create a blurring effect to what's behind. But I actually don't think that that's a slow shutter speed because all the birds appear reasonably sharp-ish. I mean, obviously there's wing movement, but most of the bodies are singular black specks on the frame. Like they're not dragged out as they would be if it was, you know, anything more than, say, a 30th of a second. In fact, I don't even think it's that slow.
The birds in the top right look quite blurred, but they move pretty quick because they've obviously starlings moving in, you know how they move in those?
Yeah.
Bunches and balls and things like that. So it's captured it. They're blurred, but right.
The nature of the way they swarm is that some of those birds would have been travelling laterally to the camera and some of them would have been travelling perpendicular to the camera.
Yep.
And so probably what we're seeing is, you know, the ones that are more blurred were travelling, you know, at right angles to the camera, and the ones that are more, you know, pinpoint, if you like, were probably in the process of flying straight towards or straight away from the camera at the point of capture. But it's a great shot.
Yeah.
It has an almost abstract quality to it. It's lovely.
It's marvelous. And you could mistake some of the birds for wave caps themselves.
Yeah.
So that the dark, the brownish waves washing against the shore, where it goes to the sky, which is a dull blue, if you've got to look twice. You've got to look into the photo to really get it.
So a perfect English summer's day by the look of it.
Dull. Well,
is there anything else in that collection of images worth having a squiz at?
Well, number two is sort of a classic on a lock with a little heart.
Cottage.
Yeah, just a stone cottage there. I actually rather liked number three, which is of the mountain.
Oh, that's nice.
That got of the Scottish Highlands with the dusted white of the mountain in the background behind a glen.
Yeah.
That looked pretty good.
That's a great case of, you know, scouting for a location from which to shoot. You know, yes. I'm sure there were probably a dozen other perfectly valid spots from which that image or a similar image might have been taken. But I think, yep. you know, the guy who's taken that shot has probably done a good walk around of that vicinity and found that exact spot that just absolutely works.
And the subtlety of the light coming up through the valley in the foreground, leading you straight through to the hill at the background,
yeah,
is quite amazing. Number six is an amazing shot.
Whoa.
That is a serious high C.
Wow.
That is that's incredible. It reminds me of the photographs of star forming in Orion, you know, that very famous astro photograph.
No, I'm not familiar with it.
You've got the clouds with, in this case, the clouds as water with spray streaming off them.
Yeah.
It just looks like a complete vortex.
It looks violent.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to be out there, I reckon, at Oracle. I don't think it would be my thing.
No.
And there's another interesting one, which is number nine, which shows a groin, which is a zigzag groin going out into the sea.
So it's a series of, like, posts?
Yeah, so the idea of that is to stop, try and prevent sand washing away. Because,
oh, okay.
Because when waves come in, they don't go straight back out, they curve out, and those sort of things
are designed. Right.
But in the background are windmills.
Oh, is that what they are?
Yeah.
Right.
That's power generation windmills, and they rather sort of juxtapose on the groin quite nicely, actually. So that gives you something visual. So, yeah, it's there's a good collection. And just one more in this group, which was number 10 that fascinated me, is just simply a sandbar where the a part of it's eroded.
Yeah.
In a rather creative way. It looks like a complete shoreline.
It's really odd because it's almost like a razor's edge along the front of it, and yet you've got all of these little inlets that have sort of been carved out of that straight edge.
Yep. Yeah.
Wow.
I think it's incredible. So
yeah.
I reckon it's a great collection for people to have a look through and have a think about.
Definitely.
And and the other one is the Wildlife Photographer of the Year.
Right. Where do I find that? Is that your next link?
That was the next link.
Oh, yep.
And hopefully it works.
Yeah.
Copy and paste.
Yep. I love the orangutan shot. That is awesome.
It is just amazing, isn't it?
Now, I can't believe that the photographer would have been up there. He must have planted the camera and then remote fired it.
That's exactly what he did. If you look at number two, it's the same image and it gives you the story of the photo. This is a 100-foot climb up a tree to get the fruit at the top. And what's interesting is that it's a strangler fig that's entwined itself around the tree. So the orangutan is going up the strangler fig.
Right. So that's the parasitic plant.
That's correct.
Right.
So he's climbed up that.
Wow.
But he... It just says Tim knew he would return because he obviously observed this orangutan.
Right.
There's no way of getting to the top through the canopy other than up the tree.
Yeah.
But he climbed up and down for 3 days by rope and placed in position several GoPros so he could trigger them remotely. So he placed them up there.
Yeah.
It's gamer than me. And again, the client, it says he pre-visualized the photograph. Just waited. So
that's great. I admire anyone who has the tenacity to pull off something like that.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's one thing to pre-visualize it, but to then, you know, have the dedication to climb a 100-foot tree 3 days in a row, and then, as you say, you know, hang God knows how many thousands of dollars worth of GoPros up there in the hopes that you're going to nail the shot that you've got in your mind. You know, there's no guarantees.
Well, he was hanging around to remotely trigger them too.
Yeah.
So, and he had to do that without interrupting the orangutan.
Yeah.
So again, there are some interesting shots here. Number three is the definitely very Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah.
With a crow and the moon and the tree and a silhouette. That's pretty handy.
Yeah. I love the fourth one. The bird having a go at the tail of the lizard that's trying to go for its nest. So.
Well, that's right. I like how they start the description here. These Indian rose-ringed parrots were not happy. There's another fascinating one, which is the one of the leopard in the street, which is number six.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Really good. There's a place in Mumbai.
Yeah,
where they tolerate the leopards.
Wow!
And he was able to set again, a bit like the first photographer. He set things up,
right,
for the leopard to trigger, and he's got the leopard stalking the streets, which is.
I love the composition of this image.
Yes,
it's just beautiful. Yeah, because you've got that single light source way up the back end of the alley. You know, which is throwing light on the two side walls of the alley. But then there's another light source, you know, in front of the door on the right-hand side, which is sort of a slightly different color temperature. And there's obviously, I don't know if it's that light source or if there's another light that is lighting up the leopard.
Yes.
It's a bit hard to tell whether it's...
There might have been a...
remote flash,
it
maybe.
It says... With a fleeting look of inquiry in the direction of the camera click, a leopard went about its business alongside people's homes. So I suspect it was just fixed light sources he was using, not flash, taking it from there. Now, there's some interesting number 10 I thought was interesting, which is a bear defending a kill against some raven.
Yeah, right.
It almost looks like a put-up job, but apparently it wasn't. Because it, you know, you got the.
It looks like it might have been photoshopped.
Oh yeah, yeah. Sort of. I shouldn't say that because I don't think it has been. I'll say that it's been well checked. But I mean, you've got the flat plains, you've got the hills with the mountains with the snow behind, and you've got the birds circling.
And the birds are just so perfectly placed.
Yep.
You know, you got those two on the left hand side, which give some weight to the image on the left hand side, and it's phenomenal. Like if that has not been doctored, he absolutely nailed the image.
Well, apparently I like the comment, which is it's rare that I like my image. I like this one, though I still get annoyed that the top raven is positioned right over Grand Teton Mountain. He's still not quite satisfied, you know.
So that probably says that it was not doctored, because if he doctored it, he wouldn't have done that. So
yeah, now
that's awesome.
Number 11 is not for the faint-hearted.
Oh, okay.
It's just as a word of warning. It is an illegal shipment,
right,
of
pangolins.
Pangolins, 4,000 of them that were illegally taken, because pangolins are the only mammal. They're a little mammal that has basically big scales instead of skin.
Oh, okay.
And they a bit like rhino horns. There's a belief in some parts of the world that if you have them, they do all sorts of things for you.
Oh, okay.
They're all the pangolins in the world are endangered. And this was a shipment that was illegally captured. And it makes a point. So it's a bit of a gut wrencher. So those that don't want to, I suggest avoid number 11, but it makes its point.
Yeah.
It makes its point very well. It's pretty sad. But no, another good collection of photographs.
So definitely.
I always think these things are worth having a look at and having a think about it.
Yep.
So from the sublime
to
the totally ridiculous.
Oh, okay.
There is a new trend for selfies.
Oh, right. Do I want to know?
Well, not really, but I like how it's from popular photography. The current high-five selfie trend requires you to throw your phone. And it says, don't do this, do almost anything else. Essentially what it is, I always thought high-fiving yourself was called clapping.
Yeah.
Above your head. So what people are doing is that they're somehow timing their mobile phone throwing the phone, looking and trying to get it to face them, and they clap.
What?
And it's a blurred image, and that is the in thing at the moment on social media. It has to be the stupidest thing I have seen.
Yep.
I just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Yeah, exactly.
I just shook my head.
Because I would imagine that very few of the people who manage to successfully get the capture probably end up catching the phone as well. They probably end up dropping the phone more often than not.
Yeah. I don't know about you, but I find these phones rather expensive.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I have enough trouble keeping it together without trying to do it deliberately, but I just... I like how it says, you know, somewhere along the way, selfies got pretty boring.
Yep.
But the novelty were things that people were trying different things rather than, okay, the trend's over, let's move on. So, yes.
Yeah.
I just couldn't. It's interesting because the tweet they reproduce, today is the proudest day of my life. I successfully took a picture of me high-fiving myself.
Wow.
Wow. Like,
somebody hasn't had much of a life to if that's the proudest thing that he's done in his life.
Yeah. Just
okay.
Talk about unoriginal. Yeah, they were the things I had, and I thought we'd finish off with a chat about a book.
Okay. And what's the book?
The book I've got for this week is The Great Life Photographers.
As in Life the magazine.
Life the magazine.
Right, okay.
Exactly, and it's published by the editors of Life. Now, for those that don't know, Life magazine began in 1936 and it closed in 1972. It was a weekly magazine. It was a weekly photo magazine. It was regarded as the epitome of photo magazines, which were very popular from the 30s right through until about the 70s, where, you know, you had the photojournalist.
Yeah, right.
A lot of pictures and a small amount of writing. And this book features the work of over 100 of photographers who have worked for Life or have done work for Life.
Right.
600 pages. It's a pretty wow. fair chunk. And it is crammed with photos.
Yeah, right.
And like the magazine, there's just a little short paragraph about each photographer and plenty of photos. Some of them you'll recognize. As you can see on that Bucco entry on the front cover,
yep.
There's one of the Fab Four in a swimming pool.
Yep.
There's a very famous photograph of, and I'll flick it through the book so I sound erudite and I know who it is.
Yeah.
It's of a guy called Dennis Stock, where he's actually pointing a camera at the photographer and using the viewfinder and the lens as his eyes.
Right.
Which is quite a dramatic photo. It was taken in 1951. There's a war photo, and then there's a photo, the first photos of a baby in the womb in colour that came out in Life, which was an exceptionally famous series. So that's just on the front page.
Yeah, on the front cover, yeah.
But this is...
Now, before you go on, for anyone who wants to have a look at this, the link that we are looking at, the link that I'll put in the show notes is to bucco.com.au, but their website is set up in such a way that you have to click on a checkbox to say, I am not a robot, let me in, before you can get into the site. And you will then need to search for The Great Life Photographers in the search box. And the search result will come back. The top option will say, we found three results. Click on that button and then click on the 2010 version of the three listings. There's a version that was published in 2010. That's the one we're looking at.
Yeah.
All right.
One of the others, I think it's 2009, is a smaller version.
Oh, okay.
The 2010 is, this, I think, the same as the original hardback, but in softback.
Oh, okay.
That's the one I've got. And
so what size is that, like an A4, or is it larger than that? Or?
Well, it's certainly fatter. But if I put it next to my A4 paper, it's slightly under A4.
Okay.
It's probably that US legal letter size.
Oh, okay.
You know how it's just a little bit shorter but the same width?
Right.
Beautifully reproduced.
Yeah.
But, you know, they had photographers like Margaret Bourke-White and Alfred Eisenstadt.
Yeah.
And the interesting bit here is they pay a lot of tribute to Margaret Bourke White in particular. Hers was the first cover photograph, and it gives you an idea of the range of sort of photography people like her did. The first cover photo was just a big, heavy industrial photo of Fort Peck Dam in Missouri. And then right opposite is some gold miners in Johannesburg in South Africa, you know, looking effete and sweaty and all that down a mine.
Right.
You flip the page and there's a 1937 photograph of a bread line in Louisville.
Right.
And underneath a poster, a big billboard, is a line of people waiting for bread. But the poster at the back is a huge, huge billboard, and it's got a family of four in a flash car, and the heading says, "World's highest standard of living. There's no way like the American way." And yet the people in the foreground are clearly destitute.
Yeah, right.
So full of irony, full of – she took the photos of Gandhi by his spinning wheel a few hours before he was assassinated.
Right.
She was one of the first people into Buchenwald.
Where's that?
Buchenwald was one of the like Auschwitz.
Oh, okay.
The death camps. And there's just a little bit – they haven't said much about many of the photographers, but this is the sort of things that – so here's a woman – hired in 1936. Of life's many photographers, few had more adventures than Margaret Bourke White. She photographed the German bombardment of Moscow in 1941, spent a harrowing night in a lifeboat after evacuating a torpedoed ship in the Mediterranean, and there's a photograph of that.
Wow.
She flew combat missions out of North Africa and covered the fighting in Italy and Germany and witnessed the liberation of Buchenwald. What?
Wow.
Amazing. The other one, there's Eisenstadt's, who's quite famous. He was the one that you mentioned that the nurse died recently of the sailor. And
Oh, yeah. Was that now, one of his?
That's one of his.
Right.
And in the introduction, there's a photograph he took of Goebbels in 1933.
Right.
And if you want to look at a face of pure evil, this is it.
Right.
And I believe a bit of the story of that photo is that he believed that Eisenstadt was a Jew.
Right.
And so the reaction is pure hatred, and yet that was very early in their regime.
Yeah, right. Wow.
So there's a whole range. These were photojournalists, and just picking out a couple, there's some names you don't know. A guy called David Douglas Duncan.
Right.
And his particularly covered the Korean War. So there's some fairly harrowing photos of the Korean War. So he's with a unit where you look at the captain of the unit who's just realized there is no more ammunition and they're in trouble.
Oy.
The page opposite is a corporal with tears coming out of his eyes in the same situation. Bear in mind that the photographer was there at the time and would have suffered the same fate as the troops.
Yeah, right.
So you got – now, he's done these war photos, and then in the next page is Pablo Picasso in the bath. You know, the sort of assignments these guys did, you know, it's sort of, whoa.
Well, I guess you wouldn't have been bored in your work, would you?
Well, that's right. It just changed.
Something different every day.
And a photograph of Ava Gardner.
Right.
Now,
am I right in thinking that Joe McNally shot for life at one point?
Let's see if he's – yes, he is there.
Yeah.
He's listed there, and again, you can go and let's have a look at his shots.
Because if I remember rightly, in the intro of one of Joe's books, he says one of my early editors, I'm pretty sure he said one of my early editors at Life magazine said to me, if you want to make something interesting, don't light all of it.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah, I don't know why, but that just burned itself into my mind when I read it. And yeah.
Now, thank you for putting me to Joe, because there's some great photos, but I've made an error because some of these photos are definitely, these are in the 90s. So I'd have to recheck this to see when life.
I was going to say, I thought life had continued beyond the early 70s.
I'm just looking that up as we speak. I don't want everyone, but it's pre-digital.
Right.
And that's really important because some of the effects people achieved, like that photograph we talked about at the start of Dennis Stock, he has a photograph. He's got a famous one of the SS United States at New York City as well as that. But in 1949, he took a photograph of a military helicopter taking off. And what they've done is that it's been on a spotlight on the tarmac and they've attached a torch to the rotors.
Wow.
And you can see the spirals of the rotors going up, moving across and moving up again. No digital. And he's had to do this using negative film.
Wow.
So it's astounding. Well, it actually says it ran weekly from 1883 to 1972, but I think it was restarted in 1936 as a photography magazine, like the photographs journalists.
Yep.
It says here it's published weekly until 72 and then as an intermittent special until 78 and monthly from 78 to 2002.
Ah, okay, right.
And then it folded.
Right.
And then occasionally it was used for commemorative supplements for 2004 to 2007.
Right.
But the images are just, they're timeless. Did you ever see Blade Runner?
Yes, I've seen it a couple of times, but not recently.
Okay, so the Daryl Hannah character.
Yep.
As she walks out with her hand on her hip and her hair all in rolls and coils when he first meets her.
I don't remember that scene, but anyway, yeah.
Yeah, well, there's a photograph here of Anne Sheridan, 1942. That's taken by Elliot Alisafan. I hope I haven't murdered his name too much. that's clearly the image that they used to stylize film.
Right.
Absolutely. So you can see how the film played homage, but this book, I've only just scraped the surface.
Yeah,
there
right.
is a lot.
What would you say, 600 pages?
There's over 600 pages. It is crammed with photographs from John Kennedy and his brother Bobby in a hotel room in shadow as they are preparing, you know, part of his presidential campaign.
Yeah.
You know, there's some animal photographs. There's, as I said, plenty of war. Sport is quite prevalent. Major events, there's a whole series of things. Science, there's a guy in a room that's designed to eliminate 99% of all outside sound in the 1940s. Snow monkeys in Japan. To be honest, there are a few words in the book. It doesn't need them.
It doesn't
the photos
sound like
are
it.
Very much, they're very dramatic, they're very compelling, and they tell a story in themselves.
Yeah, right.
You know, remember, this is done with old technologies. You don't need flash technology. It's what you're looking at through the viewfinder. These guys were using large format cameras, Graflexes, and in some cases where they could, I guess, at war with the Leicas. There's, you know, the Kappa brothers. Yeah, it's pretty compelling. So, yeah, if you look it up on BookGo, as you said before, it ranges from $20 through to about $62 delivered new.
Which sounds like pretty good value for what you're getting.
Oh, look, I think it's great value for money, and it's a book that I just pick off my shelves and just flick through.
Be a great coffee table book, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah, and it's just something to really get you thinking.
Nice.
About your photography. And Glenn often talks about a compelling photograph and about what's the subject here. This book is full of them.
Yeah.
And it makes its point. Particularly some of them become powerful when you know what happened after.
Right.
So, yeah, quite a good book. And, yeah, you could probably get it in time for Christmas.
Excellent. All right, mate.
Well, I don't get any royalties out of this.
No. Neither do I. Well, mate, thank you for joining us tonight.
No problem. Thank you very much.
That's all right. I think Glenn will be around next week. I'm sure he's biding his time, waiting to tear apart my wedding photos.
He's just probably lurking.
Yeah, exactly.
Waiting to have a go. Well, you're very game putting them up.
Yeah. So. You got any more shoots planned?
I'm actually having a week off from work, but I've got a miner's hole to fix in my backyard.
Oh yes, I saw that on Facebook. So what's the story there?
Okay, so a lot of Ararat is old gold fields, and what they did is after the gold miners had finished, they essentially bulldozed across the old miner's holes.
Right.
The trouble with that is, of course, they haven't necessarily compressed, and when you get heavy rain, they can collapse. The unsure way of dealing with it is to put a concrete cap over the hole,
right,
and sort of suspend it on the sides and bury that. And this is one that's a little larger than normal. Normally they're about a metre and a half across and round. This one is 4 to 5 metres across.
In your backyard?
In my backyard. I've dealt with six of them.
What?
But this is the big one.
Six of them?
Yeah. What we expect.
Are you not worried about there might be one under your house?
Well, there was a stipulation. We bought the house pre-built, but it's got a floating concrete slab.
Right.
So the concrete slab can cope with that.
Right.
So as long as it doesn't occur, they don't occur on the corners, then you're right. So the slab is designed to take that.
I'm hoping that when, you know, your house was built, that surely they would have done, knowing the history of the area, surely they would have done some sort of test to find a patch of ground that didn't have a big hole hidden under it?
No guarantees, mate.
Really?
The way they used to deal with it was just bulldoze it flat and pat it down. That's about it. So I know people further in town, they know that underneath their kitchen floor is a 40-foot shaft.
Jeez.
So, it's, you know, right through the goldfields, the Ballarats, the Bendigos, Ararat.
So you've got a hole in your backyard that's 4 or 5 metres across.
Yep.
And how deep?
Well, I half investigated by tumbling down to my waist and grabbing hold of a board that I fortuitously put across there. I have no intention of investigating further, but given that it's sort of square and about 4 to 5 metres across, it's likely to be 20 or more feet deep, enough to make a mess of you.
Jeez.
But if you do go down, you're pulling down a plug of clay, so that you'll go down and a whole lot of stuff will come down on top of you. So
bloody hell.
It's up to you to fix it if it's on your land.
Seriously?
Yep.
What?
And not all of these are located because remember in the gold rush, people just dug holes really nice to some extent.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was if you know how to read the creek, you can see where they're likely to be. I spare a thought for the people of Stall just up the road where they knew there was a shaft in a public park. It collapsed in a couple of years ago and they put a fence around it, and the one of the government departments has just given them a grant to cap it. It's 10 metres across and they know that it's 547 metres deep.
Jeez.
So not a place to throw the ball to the dog.
Half a kilometre deep and 10 metres wide.
Yep.
Struth.
They dug deep for the gold, and when they reopened the gold mining area in Stall in the deep lead mine there, you know, they were down over 2,000 feet and they were still finding bits of old mining equipment from over 100 years before. Places like Bendigo went deeper, and there were, up in New South Wales, I've got no doubt there would be similar stories.
Wow. It boggles the mind to think that these guys were digging that deep with hand tools.
Yep. Yeah. And, to some extent, it was a bit of good luck whether they made it or didn't make it. You know, people died from cave-ins.
Oh, I can imagine.
And if it rained, it'd be pretty miserable. Trying to keep the water off would be hard. So it was a hard slog. There was nothing romantic in it.
Wow.
It's hard work in a lot of these gold fields. Places like Mafeking, which is near the Grampians where I go most weekends, there are areas there which is just keep out. The big, deep mines are still there. They were within 4 weeks, there were 10,000 people under canvas at Mafeking digging for gold once it was first discovered. So that's what it was like.
That's crazy.
You just got to be aware of it. Be careful, you know, after a wet season. We haven't had a wet season for a few years. So.
Right.
So I called a mate who was who's got a big backhoe and a concreting business. So we're going to work next week. So I'll be delaying the photography next week.
Right. Wow. All right. Well, good luck with that.
No worries. Well, good luck with the bike.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, hopefully, you know, it gives me months of service without any grief now.
Well, just listen to your engine, mate.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, anyway. All right. Good to catch up.
Thank you.
And we will, we'll talk again soon.
Yep. And, yeah, catch you later.
Bye.
Cheers.
ShutterZincPodcast.com.
Another audio2.com quality podcast.
For questions, comments, and feedback, email theboys@ShutterZincPodcast.com.